from passing trucks, the rot of buffalo dung, the fermentation of the local cuisine that Carver found briny and nauseating. All of the sights, sounds, and smells depressed Carver, along with Claren Michiko's silent treatment of him, unrelenting since yesterday. Only Legaspi was attentive, playing giant steps on the stereo, undoubtedly informed by Claire of her father's love for bebop, the way the music flowed directly from his ear canal into his bloodstream. Of all the lands Carver had encountered, he liked France and Japan the most because of the natives' enthusiastic appreciation of jazz and admiration they extended to him. He regarded it as fate that he had met Michiko at a jazz bar in Roppongi, she a teenage waitress and he a decade older, on R&R from Okinawa, wowed by the sight of Japanese musicians sporting pork pie hats and soul patches. "How did you sleep, Mr. Carver?"
Not so well."
Carver was pleased someone cared enough to inquire.
"I kept waking up."
"Bad dreams?" Carver hesitated.
"Just restless.
Confusing." No one asked him what he had dreamt, so he said no more. They reached the demining site 10 minutes later, half a kilometer off the main black-topped road, down an earthen track to a small house and a trio of shacks on the edge of a barren acre fenced with barbed wire. As a Land Cruiser pulled up, two teenage boys leapt from hammocks strung between two jackfruit trees. Carver immediately forgot their names after the introductions. They wore oversized shorts and anomalous T-shirts,
one emblazoned with the Edmonton Oilers logo, the other commemorating a 1987 Bryan Adams concert tour.
The taller one's prosthetic arm was joined with the human part at the elbow, while the other's prosthetic leg extended to mid-thigh. Carver nicknamed the tall one Tom, and the shorter one Jerry, the same ones he and his Utapau roommate, a Swede from Minnesota, had bestowed on their houseboys. "They lost them, playing with cluster bomblets when they were kids," Legaspi explained. Tom and Jerry smiled shyly, their prostheses appearing to be borrowed from mannequins, the café au lait color of the plastic not an exact match for their milk chocolate skin. What spooked Carver about the detachable limbs was not just their mismatched color, but their hairlessness. "They guard the site and look after the mongooses." "Not mongoose?" Michiko said.
"Definitely mongooses, Mrs. Carver."
The mongoose Tom fetched from one of the shacks was named Ricky, feline in size but with a more luxuriant coat of fur and the angular, wedge-shaped head of a mouse. "We use a mongoose because it's too light to trip a mine," Legaspi said. "Meanwhile, its sense of smell is acute enough to detect explosives." Jerry carried out a pair of robots from another shack. Instead of being the sleek, stainless steel machines Carver expected, the robots were cobbled together from what looked like two tin milkshakes, joined mouth to mouth, each milkshake sporting a pair of legs made from rubber hose. Like a draft of horses, the two robots were harnessed side by side, braced front and back by iron rods. The forward rod was attached to a round blue disc the size of a frisbee. With Ricky yoked to the blue disc via a rubber vest, the entire robot and mongoose affair no more than a meter long and half that in width. "I steer the robots with this remote control." Legaspi held up a palm-sized black box of the type William had used to fly his model planes. "Ricky sniffs for the mines. The blue disc is the impediment sensor, and when it tells the robots something is blocking the way, the robots steer Ricky away from the obstacle. And when Ricky smells a mine, which he can from 3 meters, he sits up."
"That's ingenious," Michiko exclaimed.
My advisor developed it to demine in Sri Lanka, but we're experimenting with a robot and mongoose here, too."
"So what are you still testing?" said Carver.
"The legs. It's very difficult to mimic the locomotion of human or animal legs, especially over rough terrain. Having a robot vacuum your living room floor or climb some steps is completely different than having to deal with sand or grass or rocks or any unexpected thing even a 5-year-old knows how to get around." The field was planted with defused landmines. Legaspi piloted the robot and mongoose team from under a tent at the perimeter of the field, under which Claire, Michiko, and Carver also stood. Tom and Jerry followed the mongoose as it scuttled over the terrain, Tom with a metal detector strapped to his back, Jerry with a quiver full of red flags. Whenever Ricky stopped and stood up on his hind legs, Tom stepped in with the metal detector to confirm the landmine's existence, and Jerry marked it with a red flag.
"A human team would take months to clear out this area," said Legaspi. The back of his linen shirt was stained with sweat, the air humid even though the sky was gray and overcast. "You could bulldoze, but that tears up the topsoil and ruins it for farming. We can clear this in a couple of weeks for a fraction of the cost."
Carver watched Legaspi and Claire as the humanitarian jargon of cost efficiency, improvement of the land, moral obligation, employment of local technicians, and so on spooled forth. The light and focus in Claire's eyes as she watched Legaspi was the same in Michiko's when Carver told her on their first date about driving from State College to New York City to catch Thelonious Monk at the five-spot cafe on St. Mark's Place, where he stood close enough to see the yellow half-moons of Monk's cuticles against white ivory. The great man's genius had rubbed off on him enough to shine and catch hold of Michiko's gaze. It was the same with Legaspi, borrowing someone else's ideas, and this was enough for Claire.
"Do you know who you're dealing with? You ever thought about what the DOD could do with these robots?" Carver said.
The look in Legaspi's eyes was hesitant, afraid, weak. Someone not ready to face bare-knuckled reality, the clenched iron fist of power. Legaspi's naivete annoyed Carver profoundly. Some brilliant guy at a university working on a defense contract will figure out a way to put a landmine on this robot. Then the Pentagon will send it into a tunnel where a terrorist is hiding.
"That's the kind of work you would do, Dad. Don't think everyone's like you."
"It's okay," Legaspi said. "I've heard this before."
"It's not okay," Claire said. "He's old and angry and bitter, and he's taking it out on everyone he meets."
"I'm not angry and bitter. What am I angry about? What am I bitter about? That I'm being lectured to by a kid who thinks he's going to save the world with a tin can robot? That I have a daughter who thinks she's Vietnamese?"
"I said I have a Vietnamese soul. It's a figure of speech. It's an expression. It means I think I've found some place where I can do some good and make up for some of the things you've done."
"I've done? What have I done?
You bombed this place. Have you ever thought about how many people you killed? The thousands? The tens of thousands?"
"I don't have to listen to this. It's not like you've ever listened to anyone before."
"You don't understand anything. We coddled you so you wouldn't have to worry about the things we worried about. Isn't that right?"
Carver turned to Michiko for support, but she was studying the ragged copse of palm trees at the far end of the model minefield. Legaspi had returned to steering Ricky, while Claire had her arms folded across her chest, daring him to walk away, exactly as he dared her when she was six, clamoring for a blonde Barbie doll in a toy store.
"You can sit here and cry your eyes out, young lady."
She had promptly sat down in the aisle and howled with all the grief and fury only a child or someone on the brink of death could muster. He walked out of the store then, leaving her there, and he had no choice but to walk away now. The monsoon struck 15 minutes later, when Carver was a few hundred meters away from the demining site, the best he could manage on the rutted road and with his bad hip. Outrage and self-pity propelled his every step. He had never explained to Claire the difficulty of precision bombing, aiming from 40,000 feet at targets the size of football fields, like dropping golf balls into a coffee cup from the roof of a house. The tonnage fell far behind his B-52 after its release, and so he had never seen his own payload explode or even drop, although he watched other planes of his squadron scattering their black seed into the wind, leaving him to imagine what he would later see on film, the bombs exploding footfalls of an invisible giant stomping the earth. Claire's mind wasn't complex enough to grasp the need to strike the enemy from on high in order to save fellow Americans below, much less understand his belief that God was his co-pilot. She was his complete opposite, joining Amnesty International in high school and marching against Desert Storm at Vassar as if protesting made any difference at all. If it did, the help it offered was to the enemy. Although she empathized with vast masses of people she had never met, total strangers who regarded her as a stranger and who would kill her without hesitation given the chance, she did not extend any such feeling to him. The unfairness of this absorbed Carver so much, he did not notice the rapid marshalling of storm clouds until the sky grumbled. For a few seconds, scattered drops of rain pinged off his forehead. Then came the deluge. Rain glued his clothing to his body, water sluicing down the back of his collar and soaking into his hiking boots. He stopped walking, unsure of whether to keep heading for the blacktop road or turn back to the demining site. The ribbon of earthen road was now the texture of peanut butter, and he sank millimeter by millimeter into its stickiness as the monsoon's onslaught continued. This was why he hadn't wanted to visit this country, a land of bad omens and misfortune so severe he wanted nothing more to do with it than fly over it. But Claire had brought him back to this red earth, and he wasn't about to run to her for help, even if he could. He slogged toward the blacktop, not a human being or animal in sight, the dull green fields flanking him on either side. It was the middle of the afternoon, but twilight had descended with the storm clouds. In the distance behind him, a car honked. He lowered his head and kept walking, the downpour so intense he feared drowning if he looked up to the sky. He heard the car's old engine as it got closer, choking like a cat coughing up a hairball. With light from the high beams scattered and the raindrops falling before him, he decided that instead of ignoring them, he should raise his head in defiance. He stopped and turned, but somehow he misjudged this simple step, his right foot trapped by mud clutching at his ankle. With the high beams in his eyes blinding him, he made another misstep, this time with his left foot, the toe coming down straight into the mud, the leg locking at the knee, and his body pitching forward into the path of the car. The mud was wet and cold against his belly and face, its odor and taste evoking the soil in the distant yard of his childhood, the one where he had so often lain prone on the earth and played soldier. It was Legaspi who helped him to his feet and into the idling Land Cruiser, Claire hovering over them with an umbrella. They put him in the back seat, shivering, Michiko using the silk scarf she had bought yesterday to wipe the mud from his eyes and face.
"We all thought you just went to sit in the car, Jimmy," she said.
Legaspi started driving toward the blacktop.
"What got into you?"
"I'm 68, damn it!" Carver sneezed. "I'm old, but I'm not dead."
"You're 69.
He was going to argue as she scrubbed at the mud around his ears, but then he realized Michiko was right. Even his own years were elusive, time ruthlessly thinning out the once dense herd of his memories. In the rearview mirror, he saw Legaspi looking at him, and when Legaspi spoke, his voice was not unkind. "Where did you think you were going, Mr. Carver?" When Legaspi turned on the stereo, the strains of Giant Steps played once more. "You don't even know where you are." By that evening, fever had seized Carver. The dream he hadn't recounted to Legaspi came back to him in his hospital room, where he floated on his back in a black stream, his face emerging every now and again to catch glimpses of his fellow patients in the three other beds, silver-haired, aging men, tended by crowds of relatives who chattered loudly and carried bowls and things wrapped in towels. He smelled rice porridge, a medicine whose scent was bitter, the wet dog odor of very old people. When he was submerged in the black water, images flitted by like strange illuminated fish from the canyons of the ocean. The only ones he could clearly recall later were manifest in the dream, where he had woken to find himself a passenger in a darkened airliner. Everyone else was asleep, and the portholes were closed. For some reason, he knew that no one was piloting the plane, and he rose and made his way forward, his skills needed. All the dozens of passengers were Asian, their eyes closed, among them the street kids and Claire's students and Tom and Jerry. Strapped to the flight attendant's jump seat by the cockpit was their tour guide from Angkor Wat, the one who had pointed to a bridge flanked by the headless statues of deities and said, in a vaguely accusatory tone, "Foreigners took the heads." Fear clutched at Carver. But when he opened the cockpit door, all he saw were the cockpit windows peering out onto the starless river of night, the empty pilot seat waiting for him.
Dad!
Claire was kneeling by his bedside in the dark room.
Dad, did you say something?
Thirsty.
She unsealed a bottle of water and poured him a cup, holding it to his lips with one hand while propping his head with the other. He drank too eagerly and water dribbled over his lip and onto his gown. Claire lowered his head to the pillow and then wiped his chin with a napkin.
Michiko.
She's at the hotel, Claire said softly. She's been here every day, but she can't stay here at night. The floor is too hard for her to sleep on.
How long?
3 days. You've had a bad fever. You have pneumonia. You have to rest, okay?
Oh, Claire sighed.
You're so stubborn. Why did you go walking by yourself? He shifted his weight on the mattress, where a lump of foam had worked its way under the small of his back.
I'm a fool.
That's true.
Claire.
Yes.
I need to use the bathroom.
He put his arms around her neck and held on tight as she leveraged him up from the bed. She smelled of strong soap and a citrus shampoo with no hint of perfume to mask the tang of sweat. Once he was sitting on the bed with his feet on the ground, he hung an arm around her neck and let her pull him to his feet. Claire was the right size for him to lean on, her head rising a bit over his shoulder, his arm draping comfortably over her back. She kicked aside a bamboo mat on the floor and maneuvered him down the narrow passage between his bed and his neighbor's.
Careful, Dad, Claire said, steering him past a body stretched out on the floor and curled up under a sheet, head turned away from him. You'll be okay. You just need some rest.
What she wanted to say, but wouldn't, was that he should not be frightened. He was not going to die here. But he was frightened, more so than he had ever expected to be. Before Michiko and the children, he believed he would die in an airplane or behind the wheel of a very fast car, anything involving high velocity and a sudden arresting stop. Now he knew he would probably die with panic pooling in his lungs, in a place where he was not supposed to be, on the wrong side of the world. He hung on to Claire even more tightly as she clutched him around his waist, navigating him past the first body and around another at the foot of a bed by the door. When he tripped on the body's outstretched foot, a woman with short-cropped hair raised her head and snapped,
"Jai ai kantandei,"
to which Claire said apologetically, "Xin loi go." The woman must be a relative of one of the patients, or maybe a patient herself. Claire must have been sleeping on the bamboo mat by his bed. The realization burned through the fog of dizziness and fear, delivering a feeling for his daughter so strong it pained him. He remembered her infancy, when Michiko insisted on sleeping with Claire in between them. He's so worried about rolling over in his sleep onto Claire that he lay awake restless until he could worry no more, whereupon he climbed down to the floor and slept on the carpet. Not so many years later, when Claire was walking but barely potty trained and still sleeping in their bed, she would wake up, slip off the edge and land on his chest, and when he opened one eye, demand to be taken to the bathroom. The trip alone in the dark was too frightening. He would sigh, get up, and lead her down the hall, step by careful step, her hand wrapped around one of his fingers.
Dad, Claire said. The bathroom door was a pale green rectangle in the blue moonlight before them.
Dad, are you crying?
No, baby, I'm not, he said, even though he was.
Someone else besides you. My father's girlfriend lived in a condo complex made to look like a village, the stucco barracks scattered around a flat lawn spotted with barbecue pits. Behind one of the barracks, a leaf blower whined as I followed my father along a winding brick path, past a swimming pool that smelled of chlorine and up an echoing stairway. We stopped on the second floor, and my father used a key linked on the chain of his Swiss Army knife to unlock a condo door. When he called out her name, Mimi, it was the first time I'd heard it. Mimi was sitting on a white leather couch in the living room, using a remote control to dial down the volume on the television backed into one corner. She stood up, and if she was surprised to see me, she didn't show it. Her plum velour tracksuit fit snugly on her slender body. Photographs of my mother before she was married showed that she was once slim too, but by the end of her life, everything about her had thickened and sagged, except for her fading hair. When she died, she was wearing the wig I'd given to her for a birthday present, woven from real human hair. Mimi's perm resembled the wig, except that Mimi's hair was naturally rich and abundant, rooted to her head in auburn waves, the style of a woman in her 50s. "I've been waiting to meet you for so long," she said, clasping both my hands in hers. The skin of her face was beige and unnaturally smooth, like nylon stockings. "Thanks," I said. Singing on the television was a girl with crimped hair, wearing a black vinyl bodice and a red leather miniskirt. Above the television was a faded lacquer version of the Last Supper, with Jesus and the disciples framed in pink neon. My father bumped into me on his way to the couch, and I said, "I've heard a lot about you." My father turned the volume up on the television. "He wants to pee." "Of course." Mimi kept smiling as she led me down the hallway to the bathroom, where I grimaced at her before I closed the door. The bathroom was immaculate and scented with potpourri, unlike the ones in the rented houses where I'd grown up, which always smelled vaguely of mildewed plastic shower curtains and ammonia. After a decent interval, I flushed the toilet. In the car, I had told my father that I needed to use the bathroom only so I could see this woman's face and how she lived. When I checked her medicine cabinet, all I found were aspirin, beauty creams, and several varieties of nail polish. I'd expected a sample packet of Viagra, like the one my ex-wife Sam once found in my father's toiletry kit after he asked her, without thinking, to fetch him his nail clippers. When I returned to the living room, the television was off, and my father was reading the paper as he sat on the couch. Mimi was preparing coffee at the bar dividing the living room from the kitchen, where a skylight illuminated her stainless steel oven and electric range. My mother had cooked on a vintage gas oven and stove with a pilot light that kept going out, and when an aneurysm struck her down last year at the age of 53, she was working in the kitchen. I think it was the surprise of her dying so young that bowed my father down at the funeral, rather than grief or the shock of having found her lying on the linoleum floor, a pot of chicken bones simmering on the burner. "Do you want milk with your coffee?" Mimi asked. "I'm sorry," I said. "I have to go." "But you just came, and I have biscotti and croissant." "I only came to drop my father off." Above the fireplace was a black-and-white photograph framed in rosewood of a gaunt man in his 60s, wearing spectacles and a dark suit. His car was stolen last night. "So I heard. That's what comes from living in Los Angeles." Mimi noticed me looking at the photograph. "My husband passed away 5 years ago. He was a senator once, you know." "He has to go." My father put the newspaper down and stood up. "The boy has two jobs." I was 33, but my father didn't think anyone was a man until he fathered children. He'd had five with my mother. All three sons had grown taller than him, but most people, including me, tended to forget his height. People only noticed that he was a broad-chested man with muscular forearms that were still as thick as they were when I hung from them as a kid. His body remained trim enough to fit into the vintage camouflage paratrooper's uniform that he'd worn during the war. These days, he only broke out the uniform once every few months to march in the honor guard for parades and memorials in Little Saigon. He always did so with the intense stare that Sam remembered from their first meeting when she found she couldn't look away from him as if she were a wild animal transfixed by the gaze of a wilder one. Perhaps Mimi felt the same way. Her eyes were on my father as she said to me, "Come by for dinner any time." For a moment, I believed she meant it. My father walked me to the door and pointed a finger at his compass watch. Its face was the size of a silver dollar, the body and hands scratched, but still as tough as the day he'd gotten it in 1958 at the Fort Benning Airborne School. "I'll need a ride back tomorrow morning," he said. Then he closed the door in my face. "Sure," I said. "You're welcome."
I was used to the way he was spare with most things in his life, from his words to his 82 Honda hatchback. When he'd come to my apartment 6 weeks ago, everything he owned was in the car, which was original, down to the push-button radio that only picked up static-thick AM channels. Wanting to be helpful, I'd reached for his suitcase. The moment I tried to lift it, I knew I'd made a mistake. It must have contained his dumbbells, and the seconds ticked by silently as I struggled with both hands to drag the suitcase out of the trunk. When I'd finally gotten the suitcase to the sidewalk, he sighed and took it from me, lifting it with one arm and bracing it against his hip. Then he slung his duffel bag over the other shoulder and turned to the stairs. He swung the suitcase up each step with the aid of his leg, leaving me with the garment bags. Last month, he turned 63, and every grunt he gave punctuated what I should have known already. Living with him now would be harder than it was during my childhood. All through the morning, while I processed refunds and listened in on my service representatives, I pictured my father and Mimi lounging on the white leather couch, watching the Vietnamese channel on television. Mimi was the first of my father's mistresses and girlfriends that I'd seen, the mysterious women that my mother screamed about to my father behind their bedroom door when my brothers and sisters and I were younger. Now, I had a face and a name for the woman sitting next to my father under the gaze of her husband. My father hadn't even put up my mother's picture, as custom said he should have, next to the photographs of his dead parents on his dresser. I found it soothing during my lunch break to call Sam's home number and listen to her answering machine. "Hey there, stranger," she said. "You know what to do." Teaching geometry to 10th graders had trained her to speak in a gentle and pleasant way. Sam was popular with her students like my father was with his. He was a high school guidance counselor, and every Christmas, alumni would send dozens of cards to the man they affectionately called Mr. P, updating him on their careers and families. I doubted if Mr. P's students ever imagined that he had mistresses, or that once, in his past, he jumped out of airplanes and commanded a battalion of paratroopers. To the students, he'd merely say that he'd been a soldier once. He was a modest man who didn't like to talk about his other life with acquaintances or his own children any more than I told my co-workers about how, at the end of the day, I drove to a convenience store parking lot and changed in the front seat, wriggling into gray slacks and a red polyester blazer. My co-workers knew me to be a customer service manager for a company in Burbank that sold hearing aids, oxygen tanks, and motorized wheelchairs. But by night, I was a watchman at a luxury high-rise on the Wilshire Quarter near UCLA. No one could say I was lazy, as Sam had conceded during one of our arguments last year. The job was perfect, because after Sam left me and my mother died, I could no longer sleep. Nights at the high-rise were quiet and didn't require much of me. Every now and then I got up to walk the hallways, stairways, and underground parking garage, but mostly I sat in the marble lobby, watching every corner of the building via a bank of video monitors. When I wasn't reading one of the several newspapers I'd brought, I played solitaire. In between games, I would draw a random card from the deck, and if it was the Ace of Spades, I called Sam. If she answered the phone, I said nothing. Waiting to see how many times she said, "Hello?" before she hung up. She was a patient woman, but her patience ran out last year when she turned 34. We had gone to Palm's Thai restaurant in Hollywood for her birthday because she was a fan of the Thai Elvis, who shimmied and shimmered on stage in a different costume each night. That evening, he was wearing a gold lamé pantsuit as he sang a passable version of "Let Me Be Your Teddy Bear," pushing rose-tinted sunglasses up his nose with a jeweled finger every now and then. "I want a child, Thomas." Sam tucked a long strand of hair behind her ear, almost shyly. "And I want to have it with you." The strand was dyed purple, while the rest of the hair was its natural brunette. A diamond stud the size of a pinhead glittered above her left nostril, and my initials were tattooed in blue ink on her right wrist, serving as a reminder of me, she said, whenever she checked the time. For some reason, her rebelliousness had charmed my father, so much so that after our divorce, he said I was to blame. "I don't know if I'm ready yet," I told Sam. This wasn't the first time we'd had this conversation. "I don't know if I'll be good with children." "Get over it, Thomas. You're not going to turn out like your father." My father was someone who, for the better part of a decade, woke my brothers and me from our sofa bed at dawn to perform calisthenics with him. We did push-ups with one of our sisters sitting on our backs and sit-ups clutching a Webster's unabridged dictionary to our chests. We ran through an obstacle course of old tires in the backyard and used a branch of an oak tree for chin-ups, straining and grunting until we fell off the limb. After that, we practiced marksmanship with a BB gun, plinking away at Budweiser cans filled with sand. Then we ran for miles, not stopping until one of us vomited, proof that my father was succeeding in his goal of making us into men. "He's insane," I thought Sam would see the risks. "Aren't you worried I'll start my own army or keep a girlfriend on the side?" Like I said, Sam poured herself a glass of water from the pitcher on the table. "You're not your father." My shift ended at dawn. It was a 40-minute drive from the west side to my east side apartment, on a side street off the up-and-coming stretch of Sunset, not far from where the boulevard became Cesar Chavez. Stolen cars and hovering police helicopters were commonplace here in Echo Park, where I'd moved after the divorce. By the time my mother passed away during the summer, I knew what loneliness was like, and on the day after the funeral, suspecting my father might be lonely too, I invited him to come live with me. I hadn't expected him to say yes. Today was my day off from both jobs, but after sleeping for only 2 hours, I got up, showered, shaved, and dressed in 15 minutes. Half an hour later, I had crossed from Echo Park to Mimi's neighborhood, the Chinese Mecca on Atlantic and Valley Boulevards. She opened the door wearing a pink velour tracksuit. My father was showering after his morning run, and she insisted on preparing me a cup of coffee. I heard him singing in the bathroom as Mimi returned with a glass of ice in one hand and, in the other, a second glass with the condensed milk, a stainless steel filter perched on top. While we waited for the black coffee to drip, she smiled and said, "Your father speaks highly of you."
"Not as highly as he speaks of you. He says you work in the medical industry.
I sell hearing aids. In the evenings, I'm a night watchman at high rise."
"I see." We heard the running water stop.
"It's an expensive apartment building," I offered. "The women wear fur coats just because they can afford to."
When Mimi smiled at me again, a gold tooth glinted in the far reaches of her mouth. "Not good for a boy your age to be without a woman," she said. "Your father tells me you're not even dating."
"I'm recovering." Mimi ignored my comment and began describing the young women she knew at her temple, as well as the ones from her old neighborhood in Gunta, everyone searching for husbands with American passports. "Vietnamese women," she informed me, leaning close and putting her hand on my knee, "were much better mates for men than American women, who were fickle and demanding. Vietnamese women took care of their men, doted on them, and these same women wanted men like me, neither too American nor too Vietnamese." She nodded at my father, who had appeared in the doorway, already dressed in a button-down shirt and wrinkle-free slacks. Ignoring her, he looked at me and said, "Today, we're going to rent a car."
"Are you coming back tonight?" Mimi asked.
"Tomorrow," he said. "Now hurry up and drink your coffee before the ice melts." As soon as I'd finished, he ushered me out. He said nothing to me in the car, jingling the keys in his pocket until we came to a complete stop, where the Harbor and Hollywood freeways crossed. A squadron of news helicopters circled lazily over the freeway some distance toward downtown, its towers only ghostly silhouettes hidden by a curtain of smog. I lit a cigarette and my father rolled down his window. After my mother died, he quit his pack-a-day habit, even though she never complained about his secondhand smoke, just the migraines that forced her to turn off the lights in her bedroom and lie down.
"It's my head," she would moan. "It's my head."
"When was the last time you talked to her?" he asked.
"Who?"
I thought he meant my mother.
"Sam."
"Months ago."
I blew smoke out the window.
"She called to say she was sorry about Ma."
"How will you get her back if you don't talk to her?"
"None of your business."
"You give up too easy."
"Sam told me the same thing soon after we first met, our senior year in college."
"Look at you," he said.
I checked myself.
"What about me?"
"You've gained weight.
You haven't combed your hair."
He plucked at my pants. "And you haven't ironed your clothing. A man must always iron his clothing."
"I thought Ma pressed your clothes."
"The point is that you look terrible." He slapped his hand against the dashboard for emphasis. "How many of those cigarettes are you smoking every day?"
"Six, seven."
"Put it out."
When I did nothing, he snatched the cigarette out of my mouth and tossed it out the window, then grabbed a handful of the fat around my waist, squeezing it hard.
"You even feel like a woman."
"Jesus Christ!"
I pushed his hand away. "Don't do that!"
"You're never getting Sam back looking that way."
"Who says I want her back?"
"Don't be an idiot.
You were only half a man before you met her, and you're back to being half a man now." Through my window, I could see into the low-slung Mitsubishi next to us, where miniature television screens, embedded in customized headrests, broadcast a scene of a crowded highway. The camera zoomed in on a team of highway patrolmen in tan uniforms with their guns drawn, surrounding a car. It was our highway, captured live from a news helicopter.
"What about you?" I said.
"Are you going to marry that woman, and then find yourself another one on the side?" Someone behind me began honking, and soon cars all over the freeway took up the noise. I remembered my mother pulling me aside once when I was 11 or 12, demanding to know where my father disappeared to on Friday nights. I had no idea. For some reason, her question terrified me more than the time she chased him into the bathroom. When he locked the door against her, she tried to beat it down with a chair, the legs leaving fist-sized holes in the hollow door.
Sam's a good woman. My father reached over and pressed a horn once, twice, and a third time. You should never have let her go. As if to prove how little of a man I was, I started crying. My father stared straight ahead, and I knew he must be thinking of the funeral. He hadn't shed a tear during the Mass, and neither had I. But when I drove him from the church to the cemetery, something broke inside me, and the tears gushed out. My father had stopped speaking then, too. He was worried, I think, about the chances of my crashing the car. Only when I finished crying did he resume talking about the wake. But today, with horns honking all around, my father sighed and said, "Well, that's enough. It's time we did something about you." Traffic began moving. The horn stopped and my father turned on the radio. Picking a soft rock station where Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder were singing Ebony and Ivory. I didn't know what he meant by doing something, which was what he said whenever he was about to punish my brothers or me. It was also what he said the time I came home one day in the fourth grade and reported that a kid up the street had spat on the lunch of sardines and rice my mother had packed. Then the kid called me a slant-eyed fag. My father wasn't yet a high school guidance counselor at that time. He was a night shift janitor in a downtown office building and a part-time student at Cal State LA. Wearing his janitor's uniform, he made me walk him from our apartment to the other boy's house, where I waited on the sidewalk as my father went up the stoop and knocked on the front door. The man who came onto the porch was taller than my father by 6 or 7 inches and wore a mechanic's blue overalls unzipped to the bottom of his paunch. Curly brown hair sprouted from the back of his hands and over the top of his t-shirt and from his ears. Everywhere except for the top of his head. I didn't hear what they said, both of them speaking in low, angry tones, until the moment the other father said, "Like hell I will!" My father kicked him in the groin without another word or warning, and when the man doubled over, punched him in the throat. After the man fell face down onto the porch, I saw his son standing behind the screen door, wide-eyed. My father didn't bother looking behind him as he walked back toward me. There was no joy or excitement on his face as he put his hand on my shoulder. And for a moment, I thought he was going to make me fight the man's son. But all he did with that hand was to steer me home, gently patting me the entire way, saying nothing. We picked up a rental car from the Enterprise lot in Los Feliz, a Ford the size of a golf cart and only a little more powerful. Then my father took me to his barbershop in Old Chinatown, in an alley off Broadway, where a man with orange hair and a studded belt ran clippers through my hair and chuckled over his good times with the $20 whores in Saigon. After he was finished, I wasn't sure which was uglier, the rented Ford or my haircut, so short I looked like I'd been discharged from the army. I could feel the breeze on my scalp that evening, blowing in over Baldwin Hills to Sam's doorstep. She had moved here after the divorce to a townhouse on the heights above La Cienega, overlooking a field of oil derricks. "This is a mistake," I said. He knocked on the door. "We haven't seen her in a long time, and we're just going to talk." My father had said we would have the advantage of surprise, even though we were on Sam's territory. But he was getting old, because this was the extent of his plan to do something about me. He'd forgotten to reconnoiter, or prepare for a worst-case scenario. Still, even if he had remembered, I don't think he could have been prepared for the fact that when Sam opened the door, she would be wearing a maternity dress with ruffles of crepe-like material, making her swollen belly look like a piñata. "Oh," she said. Her hair was shorn into a blonde page boy, its brown roots showing. "You're the last people I expected to see." "You're pregnant," I said. "It's kind of you to notice, Thomas. Hi, Mr. P." "Well," my father said, "look at you. It's good seeing you, too." Behind her, someone was talking on the television in the living room. "I don't mean to be rude, but you should have called." "We were just taking a drive," I said, "and we thought we'd stop by." Sam knew my father and I never drove together just for fun, but she beckoned us in anyway. I expected another man to be there and entered cautiously, checking either side before stepping in. Stacks of student exams were arranged by grade on the avocado shag carpet at the chrome feet of a couch made from fake black leather that we'd shopped for together in the Korean shops on Western Avenue. "Sorry for the mess," Sam said, easing herself onto the couch. My father occupied the armchair and I was forced to sit on the far end of the couch from hers. I towed a stack of exams, one with a red C on the topmost sheet. "They're not doing so well.
I think I'm losing my touch, she replied. People say a pregnant woman glows in a beautiful way with love and expectation. I had always imagined this glow as a kind of aura, but the shine on Sam's puffy face was only a reflection from a glaze of oil and sweat. I'm not as energetic in the classroom as I usually am, she went on. It's rubbing off on the students. A teacher must lead by example, my father remarked. So you've always said, Mr. P. She closed her eyes for a moment, as if she were tired. If you'd like a beer, you can help yourself. Getting me up almost requires a crane. You have beer? I said. I keep it for guests. We should have refused out of politeness, but my father immediately went to the kitchen for the beer. Sam rested her hands on her belly and gave me a neutral look. What have you been doing, Thomas? Working. And sleeping. Me too. My father moved in with me. She laughed. That must be interesting. Who does the cooking? He's the cook, of course. My father returned with two bottles of beer, a bowl of pretzels, and a glass of water. The master of instant noodles. Thanks, Mr. P, Sam said when my father handed her the glass. I need to cool down. I'm having a hot flash. We lapsed into silence and watched the show on television about the cruelty of the meat industry's practices. When my father broke the silence and complimented her on the house, Sam explained that most of the decorations belonged to her roommate, another teacher who was out for the night. My father pointed the tip of his beer bottle at the television, on top of which was a pipe carved from teak and in the shape of a dragon with a ball of opium in its mouth. From where did you buy that? Hui? She spoke the city's name with the correct rising accent. But you can't actually smoke anything with it. You went to Vietnam? My father and I said at the same time. Last summer. I didn't teach summer school and went backpacking instead. Sometimes, she paused, a girl just needs a vacation. Did you think about me? I said. Sam shifted her weight on the couch, uncrossing and crossing her legs, the ankles and calves swollen. Of course I thought about you. She smiled at me like I was one of her students. Then she looked at my father, who was studying the cottage cheese ceiling. And you too, Mr. P. I will never go back. He wrapped his bottle of beer on the coffee table. You do not know the communists. I know the communists. They're not so bad. They just want to move on with their lives. My father shook his head emphatically. You are a foreigner. You know nothing. They take your money and say nice things to you. Maybe you should go back, Sam said quietly. You can get closure. I will never go back. My father slashed his index finger across his throat and made a guttural noise. If I go back, they will call me a war criminal. They will put me in re-education, and you will never hear from me again. Sam pushed herself off the couch, rising before my father got started about what evil the communist had done or would do. He would tell these stories for an entire evening. Excuse me, Sam said. I have to use the bathroom. After she left, my father turned to me and hissed, motioning to his belly and making a round curve in the air with his hand. I ignored him and got up to look around the living room for traces of a man. All I saw were the trappings of our life together. I'd given Sam everything when we divorced except half the money, but I hadn't expected her to keep our mementos on display. Above the mantel were figurines of hula dancers from our honeymoon in Hawaii, and on a bookshelf were crystal paperweights in the shape of dolphins we'd bought in Puerto Vallarta. By the heater was the Robert Doisneau print I'd bought her in senior year, the black and white one with a man and woman kissing on a Parisian street. Next to the paperweights was a lacquered jewelry box etched with mother of pearl, which I assumed she'd bought in Vietnam. We talked often about visiting, but I never really wanted to go. I wasn't even born there, my mother having given birth to me at a refugee camp in Guam, where my father named me after the American advisor who'd gifted him with the compass watch. I didn't understand what drew Sam to Vietnam, except maybe a need to find closure of her own. Perhaps she'd found it. She seemed happy when she brought out two envelopes of photos from her trip and told us the stories behind them. A beautiful country, she said, which was what everyone said about it. Poor and hot, but beautiful. Despite himself, my father grunted in pleasure as he studied the pictures. Sam had landed in Saigon and traveled north to Hue and Hanoi, with detours to Hạ Long Bay and the mountains of Sapa. Most of these were places he'd only read about, since the war had kept his generation from seeing their own country. He passed me a picture of Sam on the deck of a boat, wearing a safari hat and a powder blue North Face hiking jersey, the one I'd bought her for Christmas.
Her freckles had faded to invisibility against her skin, pink from the sun, and she was leaning into a man with sandy blonde dreadlocks draped on his shoulders.
"Is this the father?"
I jabbed at the man's face with my finger. She sighed.
"Oh, please don't be stupid, Thomas. It's just a question."
"You had a chance, Thomas. We had a chance." My father said, "Excuse me," got up and walked out the front door without another word. After the door closed, Sam shook her head and said, "Neither of you has changed one bit." "I wouldn't say that."
"How have you changed, Thomas, besides your haircut?" "You're the one who's changing."
My voice was loud.
"You're changing the subject."
"A woman can have a baby by herself." Her tone of voice didn't rise as it used to when we fought, but stayed subdued, as if weighed down by the unborn child. "A woman doesn't need a man to be the father of her child, Thomas."
"You might as well say the earth is flat."
"Oh my God." She stretched the words out sarcastically, imitating the way students spoke in her classes, the ones she used to talk about over dinner.
"What century are you living in?"
I wanted to ask her what a woman is without a husband, what a child is without a father, what a boy is without a man, but the questions wouldn't come out.
"Who's a father?" I said.
"You don't have any right to ask me that." Perhaps it was another teacher, or somebody she met on the internet, or a stranger she got drunk with in a bar one night. Perhaps it was even some lucky Vietnamese tour guide. The thought of these other men made me drink the rest of the beer, not so much for the taste as to give me something to do besides throw the bottle into the television. When I was done, Sam got up and walked to the door, leaving me no choice but to follow. My foot was on the threshold when the unexpected sound of my name caused me to turn around, hopeful. "Don't come back, Thomas," she said. Over her shoulder, the television narrator was intoning about corporate pipelines and Nigerian strongmen. "You know it's not good for either one of us." My father was waiting for me in the Ford, smoking a cigarette from the pack of Camels I'd left on the dash. The stereo was on, and because American music didn't please him, he'd brought along a CD of melancholic ballads sung by Kang Lee. He liked to say that whenever he listened to her, it might as well be 1969 all over again. I got into the car and turned off the stereo. The street was empty and quiet, except for the hum of traffic from La Cienega and the barking of a dog somewhere up the hill. "That was a great idea," I said. He tossed a cigarette out the window. "So did she tell you who the man is?" "She wouldn't say." I released the brake and eased the Ford into the street, lined with cars parked bumper to bumper. Halfway down the street, he said, "Stop." Sam's Toyota was next to us, pointing downhill with its wheels turned to the curb. The car was weathered and gray, and on the dusty rear window, someone had drawn a frowning face. "Kill the lights," my father said. He waited until I turned them off before he slipped out a Swiss Army knife and got out of the car. After walking once around the Toyota, he knelt down and braced himself against the driver's side wheel well with his left arm, the knife in his right hand. He drove the knife hard into the tire, working the short blade against the rubber for several seconds until the incision was several inches wide. If the knife made a sound when it came out of the tire, I didn't hear it. Once he repeated his work on the other three tires, he snapped the knife shut, stood up, and inspected the car with his hands on his hips. I looked over my shoulder, up and down the street, but the sidewalk was empty, and though some windows were lit with the blue glow of televisions, no one was looking out. When I turned back to the Toyota, my father was gone, and for a moment, I thought he'd run away. But then he rose into my vision from the other side of the Toyota, a rock the size of a grapefruit in his hand. He hefted the rock over his head, paused to check his balance, and then hurled it at the car, throwing his whole body behind it. The windshield of the car cracked and buckled under the impact, but the sagging glass held, cradling the rock even as the echo bounced up and down the hill. When he climbed back into the car, I said, "You're crazy, you know that?"
"Just drive."
He spoke through gritted teeth. "Don't turn on the lights until you get to the bottom of the hill." I waited until I turned the corner before I flipped on the headlights and accelerated.
"I don't know you."
I banged the wheel with my fist.
"I don't know why anyone would do something like that."
"She'll blame it on the blacks." All the cars around us had black drivers.
"That's not what I meant."
"So why didn't you say something?" My father leaned his head against the headrest and closed his eyes. "You could have rolled down the window and stopped me. You could have honked your horn, made people come to their windows." We drove past the oil derricks, visible as shadows in the shape of gigantic pelicans nesting. Until Sam moved to Baldwin Hills, I hadn't known Los Angeles even had oil. But I guess oil was to be found in every part of the world, just like anger and sorrow. A person only had to know where to look. I said, "No one has ever told you anything that would stop you, not from doing something you wanted." "That's because everything I've ever done, I believed in." The car hit a bump on the entrance ramp to the Santa Monica Freeway, and he cursed, clasping his hand to his neck as if a bullet had grazed him. "What's wrong?" He opened his eyes.
"I think I pulled a muscle."
"Serves you right."
"You wouldn't know right from wrong."
There was no trace of anger in his voice.
"The only way a man knows right from wrong is when he makes a choice."
"So was it right to cheat on Ma?"
Far ahead of us, the sparse lights of downtown's towers glittered.
"Was it right to drive her to her grave the way you did? Do you believe you did the right thing?" My father sighed the way he did all those mornings of my childhood when he came into the living room and saw us asleep, or pretending to be asleep, hoping he might forget to drag us out of bed. I waited for him to clip me on the ear or sucker punch me for what I said, but he didn't. He kept quiet until we were driving through downtown, when he said,
"I never loved your mother. I don't want